Sevington. Mr. McGrath.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Melissa McGrath. I'm here representing Melissa Robinson, the plaintiff appellant. Melissa Robinson finally has an opportunity to observe and hear judges consider the evidence in this case, which was disregarded, mischaracterized, and trivialized by the district court. The district court concluded that the behaviors of Judge Warren A. Sappington were not severe or pervasive enough. Melissa was not forced to resign. And even if she was out of luck because the defendants had taken reasonable care and efforts to address the harassment. The facts disregarded by the district court, Your Honors, begin with the fact that the district court concluded that the behaviors of Judge Warren A. Sappington, although sexually harassing, lasted for only a few months. The evidence presented at summary judgment demonstrated that the behaviors began in July and did not end. The behaviors never ceased. As late as December of the year when Melissa was forced to resign, Judge Warren A. Sappington was commenting about her car being parked in the parking lot. Judge Warren A. Sappington phoned the courthouse on a weekend, knowing that Melissa was there somehow, and left a phone message asking her to go out for a drink with him. Judge Warren A. Sappington's behaviors were severe and pervasive. Over those many months, Judge Sappington, on a daily basis, commented about Melissa being beautiful, commented on her personal appearance at least 100 times, called her a blonde Demi Moore at least 25 times. Judge Sappington himself conceded to commenting about her being a blonde Demi Moore, to commenting that about her personal appearance. The district court also concluded the behaviors began and then stopped when she asked for them to stop. That, too, Your Honor's misrepresented the record in this case. The evidence presented at summary judgment demonstrated that the behavior started with Judge Warren A. Sappington offering to buy Melissa Robinson a vibrator, started with Judge Sappington suggesting that, commenting about her nipples, that was not the end of his behaviors, however. The district court recognized that Judge Warren A. Sappington had told Judge Davis, although the district court got the order wrong, but had told Judge Davis that he wanted Melissa to sit on his face. Judge Francis was also involved in that discussion. Judge Sappington came to Melissa, told Melissa that Judge Francis had come into his chambers afterwards and asked if that was what Judge Sappington wanted, and Judge Sappington had told Melissa that he told Judge Francis, yes, that was what he wanted. The district court fully disregarded the fact that the day after Judge Sappington shared that with Melissa, for no legitimate reason, he came back to Melissa, he asked her if she had any questions, and he told her he would do nothing until after she was divorced. His behaviors did not stop. He circled her parents' home in an airplane. He told Ruth Young that Melissa was his goddess. He had created her. She was his beautiful goddess. Judge Sappington told Ruth Young, yes, he did want Melissa to sit on his face. He laughed, despite Ruth Young's expression of disgust. On occasions, Melissa was in tears in his chambers, in the courtroom, and others saw it. Janice Schankweiler knew it. Janice Schankweiler knew the behaviors were known by the other judges. Janice Schankweiler testified that judges knew Judge Warren A. Sappington was jealous of Melissa. The behaviors in this case crossed the line and were severe and pervasive. Melissa Robinson has a right to present these facts to a jury. The district court concluded Melissa should not have been threatened by Judge Sappington's behaviors. No reasonable person would have been threatened by Judge Sappington's behaviors. The district court mischaracterized her testimony in indicating that Melissa had testified in her deposition that when Judge Warren A. Sappington placed his hands on her face and forced him to look into her eyes and told her that if she shacked up with anyone, he would kill her. Melissa had testified, according to the district court, that she was fearful of rape and murder. Melissa didn't testify to that. Melissa said she didn't know what to think. She didn't know how to respond. And a reasonable person would not feel threatened by a 20-year circuit court judge behaving in that manner to his judicial clerk. I submit, Your Honor, that a jury has a right to make that determination. Judge Warren A. Sappington called Melissa into his courtroom, had an assistant state's attorney describe a gruesome murder of a woman by the name of Karen Slover, who was dismembered during the murder. Had that murder described to Melissa, had the assistant state's attorney leave the courtroom, and Melissa said, what did you tell me that for?
Was that part of a judicial proceeding?
No, it was not, Your Honor. In fact, she was summoned to the courtroom. There was no court in session. She was summoned to the courtroom. The judge summoned Mr. Hohler, the assistant state's attorney, and had him describe the murder. There was no judicial proceeding going on. And when Melissa asked, why did you do that? Judge Sappington said, because you're beautiful and naive, and you'll end up just like Karen Slover. These behaviors, at a minimum, must be heard by a jury so a jury can decide if reasonable persons would be threatened by this behavior.
There's an indication in the record that on many occasions he circled her mother's house in his plane looking for her. Is there any indication as to how often that happened? How many times that was?
Judge, I can't represent that there was, only that it had happened on more than one occasion, and Ruth Young had testified that Judge Sappington had in fact told her that he flew around in his airplane looking for Melissa.
Ms. McGrath, I think we all have an understanding of what happened, but I wonder if you might focus a little bit more on the response of the authorities to this, because that the case may very well turn on whether or not that response was adequate.
Sure, Your Honor, and the facts there were that Melissa reported the behaviors to Janice Schonkweiler. Janice Schonkweiler initially took no action and then told Melissa to call Judge Granius. Melissa called Judge Granius at home. He did place her on leave for a short time. He told her he'd call her the next day. He didn't call her. She called him. Judge Greenis, Your Honor, I can't tell you for sure what happened here because it's a hot potato. Everybody says somebody else is responsible here or did something. Judge Greenis says he never transferred Melissa to Judge Diamond. Judge Greenis testified the only transfer he made of Melissa was to Judge Francis, which was 2.5 months later.
But she did go to work for Judge
Diamond. She went to work for Judge Diamond.
Who made that transfer?
Janice Schonkweiler. When she came back from her very short leave, Your Honor, Janice Schonkweiler told her, you're going to work for Judge Diamond. And by the way, Judge Granius told me to tell you, Melissa, don't call him again about sexual harassment. You go through me. Melissa went to work
That was standard operating procedure, was it not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That was the standard operating procedure in the office. Matters like this were to go to the administrator.
If you look at the sexual harassment policy, she should have had a right to report it to Judge Granius, but no one got the sexual harassment policy, so that would be an issue as to what action they took also. She was transferred to Judge Diamond for 1 week. Janice Schottweiler made her go back to work for Judge Staffington because the judicial clerk, who had temporarily been assigned to Judge Diamond, didn't like working for Judge Staffington. So they make Melissa go back to work for Judge Staffington. It's not until 2.5 months...
How many judges were there in this circuit court total?
Judge, I can't tell you exactly. I'm going to estimate eight. Eight.
And in terms of the sexual harassment policy, as I understand the record, it was never posted and was never distributed, and that your client got it around the time of her resignation.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, the district court indicated, commented in its order that, well, it wasn't posted, they were in a temporary courthouse. There was no evidence in the record that it was ever posted in the permanent courthouse or the temporary
and
courthouse.
And was there any evidence at all that the judges, there was any attempt to educate the judges or other supervisors about what sexual harassment is and how it should be handled?
Your Honor, the evidence was to the contrary. At least two judges who I deposed, Judge Staffington himself, Your Honor, indicated he had never seen the sexual harassment policy, wasn't aware of it. At least two other judges who I deposed, I believe Judge Hendrian, indicated that they had not been aware of the sexual harassment policy prior to this matter coming about. Judge Whipple, back to you, what else did they do? They then, Judge Granius talks to her because Melissa goes to him again and says, is there anything you can do in general terms? And Judge Granius testifies that he transferred or talked to Melissa about transferring to Judge Francis. Judge Granius testified the transfer to Judge Francis had nothing to do with the sexual harassment. In fact, Judge Granius testified he did no investigation, he questioned no one, he had no notes, he did not view the behaviors as sexual harassment.
Well, at some point here he did speak to the offending judge, did he not?
Judge Granius testified that he communicated to Judge Staffington that his behaviors were somewhat offensive to Melissa. Judge Staffington testified he didn't recall having any conversation like that. Judge Granius also testified, Your Honor, that with regard to the sit-on-face comment, that he had in a judge's meeting with the circuit court judges, disclosed that comment was improper. I deposed each of the circuit court judges who were in that meeting, and none of them had ever been in a meeting where that comment was discussed or where anyone was reprimanded about it.
Tell me more about this transfer to Judge Francis. As I read the briefs, I gather there was a caveat given by Judge Granius with respect to the transfer, am I correct?
There was, Your Honor. And in fact, Melissa confirmed it herself because she was outside of Judge Granius' chambers when Judge Francis went in to talk to Judge Granius. Judge Francis came out slamming the doors, glaring at her, and looking angry. Judge Granius told her Judge Francis did not want the transfer, that he would make her first 6 months hell, and he ultimately told her, Your Honor, that she would be emotionally and physically better off resigning because he, Judge Granius, could not protect her, whether it be in a different courtroom or a different courthouse, so she would be better off resigning. The reason Judge Granius testified that he was even considering this transfer to Judge Francis was because he needed to protect Judge Staffington from unfair criticisms of Judge Davis.
What was that all about?
There was some evidence in the record that Judge Davis was concerned about things that Judge Staffington allowed his judicial clerk to do in the courtroom. When I asked Judge Granius in deposition, had Judge Davis complained about other judicial clerks? Yes, he had. Well, had you considered transferring them? No, I haven't. I asked him, well, did you consider at all that Judge Granius testified, well, I thought it might be nice if Melissa was away from Judge Davis. He kind of threw that in, and that might be nice, and that was the other reason for the transfer to Judge Francis. I asked him, did you think it would be nice for Melissa to be away from Judge Staffington? And Judge Granius responded, I don't know. Your Honor, if we get to the stage of whether reasonable efforts were taken here, that's what they did. Judge Granius told her nothing that would help her. She asked the judge, is there anyone else who I can be transferred to? To contend that she had anything but no choice than to resign. She's already forced to go back to work for Judge Sappington because somebody else doesn't want to work for him. She's told her next 6 months, after she's already been through 5 months of hell, her next 6 months are going to be hell with Judge Francis. And even despite even beyond that, Judge Granius said he couldn't protect her. Melissa had no choice but to resign. Constructive discharge, this court has already found, is a tangible employment action, and the case should be sent back for a jury to determine the issues. Again, if we go beyond the reasonable efforts, they took none. And Melissa had no choice other than the action that she took. A recent ruling by this court, Your Honors, Quantock, commented on the position of authority of the sexual harasser. I submit, Your Honors, we could have no greater a position of authority than an associate judge on the bench for in excess of 20 years. We could have no greater than position of authority.
When did he leave the bench?
Your Honor, he left the bench shortly after a Judicial Inquiry Board investigation began. He retired.
When?
I want to say January of 1997, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The behaviors were of a stalking nature. The position of authority could not have been greater. This court in the Heinrider case, Your Honors, recognized that where individuals are mistreated by co-workers or supervisors once they report the behavior, that clearly worsens their conditions of employment to the extent that it's actionable. Testimony demonstrated everyone was angry about the transfer, potential transfer to Judge Francis. Everyone then would not even speak with Melissa. She was shunned by her supervisors, the judges, and her co-workers. She had no choice but to resign. We ask that this court allow a jury to decide the issues.
Would you have viewed it as an adequate response if she had been transferred to an associate judge in another county? I've now looked it up. The Sixth Judicial Circuit has 13 circuit judges and 11 associate judges. So there are a total of 24, but they're spread over 5 counties. And Macon County, of course, has a fairly small number. And one of the problems in a case like this is that it's a small numbers mix. And if you have other judges like Diamond and Francis who are happy with their own staff, it becomes very difficult to make changes that will solve the problem. Do you think it's appropriate in a case like this to make a transfer out of county?
Because I think if it does not inconvenience the victim too much, I don't think... Judge, I think this court has recognized the victim...
Exactly. Part of the problem in a case like this is that often one can move the offending supervisor, but given the way in which judges are elected in Illinois, that's probably not possible. So one has to move in other directions.
Judge, they could have transferred Judge Sappington. First of all, counseled him and reprimanded him would have been a nice start, but they could have moved him to the separate court facility where Judge Francis is located. Why make Melissa move? The problem here, Your Honor...
Can you? Maybe I just need to ask... Maybe we just don't get this far in this appeal. But could you move a judge in Illinois without moving another judge in the opposite direction?
Judge, I was only talking about the physical location of Judge Sappington. They had two separate court buildings. Judge Francis's courthouse was located in a separate building that was part of, you know, get her away from Judge Davis and somehow solve the problem between Judge Davis and Judge Sappington. But they could have had Judge Sappington hear his cases in the separate building. I would submit, Judge, it's possible that a transfer to a different location for the victim may be feasible, but I also think this court recognizes that the employer had an obligation to consider all options. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Murphy Petros.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Melissa Murphy Petros on behalf of Defendant Appellee Judge Warren Sappington. There are 3 points I would like to emphasize today. First, Judge Sappington's offensive conduct ended after plaintiff complained about it, and it never resumed through the end of her employment. Plaintiff's statements to the contrary on that are misrepresentations of the record.
She left the bench when?
You left the bench on December 10th of 1998. And, you sat from September of 1977 through December 10th of 1998, and that's at page 3 of our brief. Plaintiff deposed very specifically that the offensive behaviors ended after she complained of them, and this is found at pages 108 and 109 of the first day of her deposition testimony. Even when she was transferred back to Judge Sappington, he was no longer engaging in the behaviors which she found offensive. She testified that the relationship had become a very professionally cold relationship. She said she stopped speaking to him, he was not speaking to her. Then she called the relationship professional but non-communicative. There was no more offensive conduct going on
It wasn't a normal relationship between a judge and his or her clerk, right?
She said it was professional. I think the judges and their
clerk.
And
cold.
And non-communicative. How does a clerk work when they don't talk?
Well, that was not explored in her deposition testimony, but I think the key fact in this testimony that it establishes is that the offensive behaviors had stopped, and that includes the personal appearance remarks. Contrary to what she says in her briefs and before this court, they did not continue through November. Her deposition testimony, again, makes clear, and this is at pages 82 and 83 of the transcript of her first day of testimony, and again at page 71 of the second day of her testimony, she says the remarks began in July and they ended in October. They did not continue through November. At the time she left her job, she was not experiencing any offensive conduct from Judge Francis. And that brings me to my second point. She was also not experiencing offensive conduct, from Judge Sappington previously. She wasn't experiencing any offensive conduct from Judge Francis. Although she speculated that she might have been treated badly by him or that he might have sexually harassed her, there's no evidence on these points in the record. She never went to work for him. There's no way to know.
But the guy who was supposed to remedy this situation, the supervising judge, when he gave her the alternative, said, by the way, it's not terribly hot. Was that really a viable alternative?
Absolutely, it was a viable alternative. Again, there is no way to know that Judge Vanius, you know, of course Judge Francis admitted he did not want the transfer. He had his own staff. He was happy with them. But he said he would do what it took to make the transfer work. He offered to let plaintiff come to his courtroom to observe his procedures, to learn about how he handled things. She declined that offer. She never gave him a chance. He said he would have treated him.
I got to this point in all the parties' briefs that went to me, isn't that impression I had was, boy, you know, this at this point, wasn't the plaintiff quite justified in saying, I'm sorry, I'm out of here.
No.
Not only have I been harassed, but you're playing games with me. You sent me to one judge for a week, you sent me back to the harasser, now you're going to send me to another judge, but you're telling me my life's going to be a real problem for the next 6 months, and the judge gives her, who she's going to, gives her a little demonstration of his anger on the way out of the office. It wouldn't be a reasonable thing at that point for her to say, I'm sorry, people are not playing with ball and good faith around here. I'm out.
No. This court has established time and again that an employee is expected to remain on the job to work out differences absent the most extreme and egregious circumstances. She was not experiencing any offensive conduct from Judge Sappington. She never gave Judge Francis a chance to work with him at all. Nothing was happening to her at the time she lost her job.
Encouraging her to work with him to say, your life will be hell.
Judge Francis didn't say that. Judge Francis said he would have treated her like any other clerk. His direct quote is, I didn't have anything against me.
Yeah, but Judge Graney's comments about Judge Francis being, quote, a ladies' man and difficult to work for. That's in the record.
Again, his rumors and speculation about what how Judge Francis may have behaved are just not the basis for a constructive
discharge.
Yeah,
but that's
claim.
What the judge in charge of correcting the situation said to her. That's a problem.
Judge Granius did not say anything to her about Judge Francis's reputation. She states that she had heard this information from Judge Sappington, and this was her own personal fear. Judge, she never worked with Judge Francis. There simply was no way to know. The third point that I would like to make is to address plaintiff's argument that Judge Sappington should be held to a different standard because of his position as a judge. This simply has no legal basis. Title VII does not carve out any exceptions that would relax a plaintiff's burden of proof where the defendant happens to be a judge.
You may have a point there, but don't we have a right to take, don't an obligation, to take into account closeness of the working relationship in this situation. Now, this is not a huge plant where the chances of an encounter are not great or where there are other people around to perhaps cushion these blows or to make them less offensive. This is a judicial chambers. There are very few people around. There is no question as to who's in charge. Don't we have a right to take all of that into consideration? That would certainly make this a far more intense situation for this person.
I think certainly the size of the workplace is a factor that may be considered by the court, but that's not what the plaintiff's arguing.
The type of relationship between the judge and the court.
The plaintiff's arguing that because he's a judge, this should be viewed differently. And again, and she said today, you know, there is no one of any higher authority than a judge.
But can't you deal with that in terms of there being of the relationship between judge and law clerk? There's a relationship of extreme power over the employee.
I think that any instances that can be drawn from that relationship would simply go to the subjective element of the hostile work environment claim in terms of how she perceived what was going on. But the district court found that she had met that strong.
You shouldn't forget is judges what we know as people?
Exactly. Title VII, again, carves out no exceptions.
Don't we know exactly what kind of have a very good idea what kind of a relationship does exist in the chambers?
Perhaps, but again, I think that anything that can be gleaned from that goes to the subjective element. It does not go to whether or not he created an objectively hostile work environment. And that's established in the Jones v. Clinton case. There, as we all know, the defendant was the President of the United States when he was sued. He was the governor at the time of the alleged conduct, and the court did not consider those factors in determining whether or not his alleged conduct created an objectively hostile work environment. So I think that her arguments there really have no legal basis. Anything that she might have felt because he was a judge goes to the subjective element of her claim, which the district court did find that she met when she testified that she felt harassed.
So you're saying that the environment in which a particular plaintiff works, the circumstances of that environment, how large it is, how small it is, how many workers are there, those are all subjective factors. I mean, that's what it boils down to, because cases talk about the environment in which a plaintiff works. And as Judge Ripple pointed out, if it's a large company and it's a factory floor, there are lots of people, likelihood you're not going to run into the harasser, all those, are you saying all those factors are irrelevant?
No, I'm not saying
we don't have to have a higher standard for a judge. If what we're doing here is looking at the specific environment under which she operated.
I'm not saying that those factors are irrelevant. I am simply addressing plaintiff's argument that her unique argument that his position as a judge is an additional factor that must be considered.
So
and it simply is not.
Therefore, you concede that the small environment and their close working relationship is a factor we should take into account.
Certainly, and the case law establishes that. But that by itself does not render Judge Sappington's conduct objectively hostile under the cases that have been set forth by this court, such as Baskerville, Pryor, Weiss, Gallo. Many of those cases involving small office situations like those at issue here, the court looked at conduct that I would submit is far more egregious than what Judge Sappington did and found that it was not objectively hostile. That conduct like what is alleged here simply does not, as this court said in Hernreiter, justify trundling out the heavy artillery of federal anti-discrimination law. I would like to answer one question. Judge Williams, you had asked how many occasions about the flyover, the alleged flyover with the airplane. That plaintiff testified that that happened once. And that is in our brief, along with the record citations. I think that was the only thing that that is in our brief with the record citations. She said one time, not many times. One occasion. She was also not able to pinpoint a specific date when that happened. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hardy.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is William Hardy. I represent the defendant appellee, Judge John Schonkweiler. I'd like to start out by clarifying that Judge Schonkweiler is the chief judge of the circuit, and this sort of goes to one of your questions about the way this is made up, the circuit. Judge Schonkweiler is based in Piatt County. There's no evidence in this case that Judge Sappington or that the plaintiff or that Janice Schonkweiler ever told Judge Schonkweiler about what was going on here. The evidence is that basically Judge Grenius was handling this as presiding judge of Macon County. He solely made the decision and so forth. Now, it's our position that there's no reason for Judge Schonkweiler to be involved in this case, and we point that out in our brief. And that's because the claim against Judge Schonkweiler is a claim in his official capacity, just as the claim against Judge Sappington is in his official capacity. Although there was an independent or an individual capacity claim against Judge Sappington in the beginning, that was dismissed and never appealed. So, I mean, there's absolutely no reason for Judge Schonkweiler to remain in the case. And I know plaintiff's counsel in the brief tries to create some question of fact there, but the fact of the matter is, Judge Grenius had a few conversations with Judge Schonkweiler. Judge Schonkweiler was never there to personally observe any of this. So we would ask that the court affirm the dismissal as to Judge Schonkweiler. Now, with respect to the sexual harassment, I think it's very important for this court to understand the relevance of the evidence of Judge Sappington and the plaintiff's prior relationship. Plaintiff argues in her reply brief that everything that happened prior to 1996, July of 1996, when he came back from China, is totally irrelevant. The fact that they had the best working relationship in the courthouse, the fact that she read the paper there, and they went to lunch together and so forth, plaintiff claims that's all irrelevant. I suggest to you that it's very relevant to both the subjective and objective component of plaintiff's claim. The plaintiff basically testified, and I think it's important that you review her whole deposition, as I'm sure you have or will, because I think the plaintiff's counsel is making these isolated individual incidents out to be much worse than they were. Plaintiff testified that when these things happened, she said, repeatedly called the conduct bizarre or irrational. She thought it was irrational. She talked to several lawyers, Glenn Fuller and I think Ruth Waller, about how this was just so odd and so uncharacteristic for Judge Sappington. And I'm not defending the conduct. It was bizarre in my view, and it was very odd. But in terms of whether it's sexually harassing, I think you have to look at the way the plaintiff reacted and the way a reasonable person would have reacted. And under these circumstances, the plaintiff thought that he was having a mental breakdown. The plaintiff said, well, this is so out of character for him. I thought he was suffering from a mental breakdown. I heard the words he was saying. I saw what he was doing, but I didn't believe them. And in fact, in the end, when the proposed transfer to Judge Francis was taking place, the testimony, and this is undisputed, the plaintiff doesn't respond to it in her reply brief, is that she wanted to continue working for Judge Sappington. She didn't want the transfer to Judge Francis. And during that meeting, Judge Grenius said to the plaintiff, look, I think you've been psychologically and emotionally abused. This transfer would be good for you. plaintiff's exact words were, no, I wasn't psychologically well. I don't remember exact words, but the quote was, no, I disagree with that. She didn't think she had been psychologically or emotionally abused. So I think it's, I agree with the plaintiff that all of this has to be taken in the totality of the circumstances. And the plaintiff argues in the reply brief that we don't do that. We just isolate the incidents. Well, I suggest to you that exactly the opposite is occurring here. It's the plaintiff who's taking these incidents out of context. The plaintiff wasn't offended by much of this. And sure, a lot of these comments were inappropriate. They were bizarre. They were irrational. But this man was some 40-some-odd years older than the plaintiff. And I submit to you, when you review the deposition, he was acting very strange for someone his age. But was it sexual harassment? Did it rise to the level of satisfying both the subjective and objective components? I submit to you that it did not. So for those reasons, I would ask that the court affirm. In the alternative, if the court reverses this matter as to Judge Saffington, we respectfully request that as to Judge Schonkweiler, there's absolutely no reason for Judge Schonkweiler to remain a defendant in this case. Unless the court has some questions, that's all I have. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cassidy.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is John Cassidy. I represent Macon County in this action. Counsel. This case involves, from my perspective, Macon County, which is a local government entity, a judicial clerk suing a county, a local government entity, for the actions of her superior judge, all within the judicial branch. The constitutional implications of the under Title VII cause of action. The constitutional implications of a county getting involved in the judiciary are apparent, which I've covered in my brief. And I would like to point out, Your Honors, is it's not even necessary that the county be involved, even though they were far separated from this because of the separate branches of government, because there was a sexual harassment policy within the judicial branch.
Did you suggest in the district court that the state of Illinois be substituted for the county as the correct defendant?
No, my position was the county should not be in it at all. I don't recall ever suggesting.
In your view, who is the employer for purposes of Title VII?
Would be the state of Illinois.
So why didn't you ask for the state to be substituted for the county?
Well, I believe, Your Honor, when the judges were sued in their official capacity, Your Honor, that the state was involved. In other words, I believe when the judiciary was named and them individually in their official capacity, there's no issue that these judges were employed by the state of Illinois, and when they were sued in their official capacity, the state was involved.
So Judge Saffington's counsel also represents the state of Illinois?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, yes, Your Honor. In fact, Judge Saffington was represented by the Attorney General in this action at every deposition. An attorney by the name of Karen McNaught with the Attorney General's office. That's correct. So, to go forward in this, the judicial branch covered this. There were sexual harassment policies. They were complaints made to the judicial branch. There were some questions as to what was done. It was all handled within the judicial branch. The county was not even aware of this until after the filing in the Human Rights Commission. And we had no knowledge of this. Now, my position is on this. I've covered in my brief, actually, there's two requirements for the for a plaintiff to sue an employer, and that requires a traditional employment agent, traditional employment relationship. That's the Alexander case that was put down, written from this court. There was no traditional employment relationship in this case because the surrounding factor is control. Well, because of separation of powers, constitutional concerns, there could be no control by the county over either judge or his judicial clerk. It's just not possible. And in fact, the Illinois State Supreme Court has said that. In the case that I have cited, Ornick versus the Illinois State Labor Relations Board, this specific issue was actually brought, and the Illinois Supreme Court indicated that judicial clerks are not employees of the county, but rather solely employees of the state. And then the Seventh Circuit, because of separation of power concerns.
Who provides the budget for the Sixth Judicial Circuit?
Your Honor, we provide the budget, but this is addressed in Ornick and in Warren v. Stone, the Seventh Circuit. They specifically stated, I put in my brief, that the mere fact that they pay the salaries, and that's it, and the benefits, does not make them employees of the county because of the separation of concerns. There is no other involvement of the county other than paying for the salaries and the benefits. But more importantly, Your Honor, on the other side, there's constitutional concerns about conduct of judges.
You may know the Supreme Court of Illinois recently in Carver against the sheriff of LaSalle County held that even though the county couldn't hire or fire the sheriff, he was an independently elected officer, since the county was the one supplying the budget, it was on the hook for any judgment. Now, that might imply that if the county is the budgetary officer, it has to be a party here, even though it's not technically the employer.
No, Your Honor, that would be there's no separation of power concern in that particular case. A sheriff and is not a separate branch of government than from the county than the judicial branch of government.
As far as the federal government is concerned, separation of powers within the state is for the state. We're just trying to make sure there's somebody here who is the employer and somebody who will pay the judgment.
Right.
Now, if under Carver the county is going to pay the judgment, we said in our opinion after the Supreme Court of Illinois decided in Carver on its reference from us that made the county a necessary party because it was the person that was going to satisfy any judgment.
That would be the indemnification statute. That's when the county or the sheriff is sued. But in this particular case, we're talking about an employee. This is a Title VII case where employment relationships are important. And the employment...
Carver was a Title VII case, too.
Correct, but that was a sheriff. What we're dealing here is the case involving judges within the judicial branch. That raises separation of power concerns. Furthermore, the Illinois Constitution disallows anybody but the Supreme Court to pass rules of conduct and to discipline judges. How could you count on that?
You may not be understanding the purport of my question. It was taken as a given in Carver that the county had no control whatsoever over the sheriff, the sheriff's employment policies, the relation between the sheriff and the plaintiff, and so on. But nonetheless, the Supreme Court of Illinois held that because it was the budgetary authority, it was on the hook. And right, you're just saying because of separation of powers, the county can have no control whatsoever.
No,
that just makes it a play of Carver.
I would respectfully suggest, Your Honor, that you read the Ornick case, where they specifically address the issue of judicial clerks in regards to county employment. And in that particular case, they specifically said that they cannot be the same. There can't be joint employment, that only the state of Illinois is the employer. And as a consequence, I believe the Carver case is distinguishable.
Thank
you, Your Honor.
Now, Ms. McGrath, we took up all your time, but I took up about your last 2 minutes with a question when you were trying to reserve some time for rebuttal, so we'll give you 2 minutes if you would like.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Your Honors, we're not submitting here that Judge Saffington should be treated under a different standard. What we are submitting or what we are indicating to this court is that he, in this case, should not be treated any differently.
Why did you sue the state of Illinois? Aren't they the employer?
Judge, in my view, suing Judge Schonquire and Judge Saffington in their official capacities was suing the state of Illinois. I would like to address Judge Schonquire's knowledge of the facts, contrary to counsel's representation. Judge Granius testified that he had told Judge Schonquire about certain behaviors. Judge Granius, of course, did not recall what behaviors he told Judge Schonquire about, other than he knew the sit-on-the-face comment was one, and the flying over the home was one. Janet Schonquire told Melissa that Judge Schonquire knew about the behaviors. When I asked Judge Schonquire in his deposition why, after he learned about the sit-on-the-face comment, when Melissa was still employed as a judicial clerk, why he did nothing at that point, he had no explanation.
see my additional time.
You have one minute left.
I also only wanted to note for the court, correct my representation, Your Honor, and I apologize about that. Melissa may have testified to the frying only happening once, but Ruth Young did testify that it had happened on a number of occasions. With regard to Judge Francis and the comment about her being emotionally and psychologically abused, I'm sorry, Judge Grania, Judge Sappington was present when Judge Granius made that comment. Any reasonable person may not have been in a position to comment any way other than what Melissa stated. With regard to Judge Francis, a point I forgot to make, it was regard to the sexual harassment. Judge Sappington was the one that told Melissa that Judge Francis had been involved in sexual harassment of judicial clerks or court personnel. Judge Sappington was present when Judge Granius became aware of that behavior. Judge Granius did not try to clarify that with Melissa and say, well, I've investigated that, or I'll look into that, or take any action.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement. Our third case this morning is United States.